Good evening and welcome to tonight's debate. This is the first debate in a series of discussions entitled The New Economy of Art, organised jointly by ArtQuest, the Contemporary Arts Society and DAX. My name is Jelaine Tawadros and I'm the Chief Executive of DAX, and I'm delighted to welcome you here tonight. Tonight's debate is entitled, What Are We Worth? Artists and the Economic Crisis. Crisis is a much overused word, but it just may be an understatement in the current economic times we're living. And although I'd personally become inured, as maybe some of you have, to the predictions of imminent doom in the financial pages of The Guardian, when the rather cautious and conservative Mervyn King, governor of the Bank of England, observed that this was the worst economic crisis since the Depression, I started to suspect that it actually might be far worse than the politicians and policymakers were prepared to admit. Tonight, we'll be avoiding Greek debt and the imminent collapse of the euro, and we'll be concentrating on the impact of what must surely be now an economic Armageddon, then, on artists and their capacity to sustain a livelihood and a practice through the turbulent times ahead. While, and I'm sure those of you who are there also may not have discerned any whiff of recession, let alone economic crisis, at the Frieze Art Fair last week, the anecdotal evidence from artists across the UK is that they're starting to feel the very severe impacts of recession and public funding cuts. The last time that Britain suffered a recession in the late 80s and early 90s, artists demonstrated extraordinary resilience, imagination, and creativity, creating the spaces and means for themselves to make, show, and sell work. The current crisis will undoubtedly act as a platform for the energy, innovation, and sheer chutzpah of British artists, but it's also going to be a very significant challenge. So our question tonight is, how can artists address this challenge? And I'm delighted to welcome three very distinguished speakers. First to speak, on my right, will be John Kiefer, who will be giving a keynote address to kick off the discussion. John has over 25 years of experience in cultural policy, arts funding, and creative programming. He's worked with hundreds of arts organizations and held senior posts at the British Council and Greater London Arts, among many others. My favorite description of him, though, was on somebody's blog, who described John as a great guy with a big brain. Responding to John's keynote talk from an artistic perspective will be two extraordinary artists. The term global artist could have been invented with Zineb Sadira in mind. She lives and works across three countries and two continents and consistently makes exquisite and profoundly moving works which provocatively explore themes of movement, migration, and displacement. Bob and Roberta Smith, the single gentleman at the end, is an artist who has consistently challenged established ideas about creativity and artistic practice, producing compelling and lyrical works which challenge the status quo. Most recently, he's gone head-to-head with Michael Gove, Secretary of State for Education, challenging his ideology and education policy, and perhaps less contentiously, his dress sense. So, our first speaker is John Kiefer.
Hello, everybody. I'm not going to talk about Greek debt, but I am going to delve a little bit into the current crisis we're in at the moment. I think we're seeing probably what is, I mean, today's news was that we have the highest inflation rate for 20 years. I can go on. You all know what the indicators are and so forth. But I think what we're seeing is probably a kind of major periodic crisis in capitalism, nothing less than that. And I think generally global economic crises are always very good news for the very rich, very bad news for poor people. And I would argue that in the UK particularly, there'll be a major shock for all of us, people like me actually, who joined the middle class post-World War II, and we may well be sent back packing to where we came from. So most people will be poorer, and many will be much poorer. I want to talk a little bit about the context for artists here as well. And I think the good news is that in terms of public funding, where we're starting from, certainly before April of this year, is probably there's more money for the arts in the UK than there ever has been before. And arguably more money than in plenty of... We're used to, I think, talking about how we don't spend enough money on the arts in the UK. But in fact, the point we arrived at was that we're actually spending a hell of a lot of money on the arts. So however bad it gets, and however much that is reduced, it's probably going to be reduced from a much higher level than we might have been at 20 years ago and so forth. From that point of view, and I think, arguably, I remember once cornering a Secretary of State for Culture and actually asking her about cutting the arts and so forth. And she finally got her drunk and she admitted to me that, in fact, the arts, we don't spend that much money on the arts and they're not that important. So at the end of the day, sometimes we leave them alone when we probably should cut them. So I don't know whether that's going to bear out, but it's be interesting to see how that kind of rolls out. Just look a little bit and I'm going to talk mainly about England, I'm afraid, so apologies to anybody here who's from Scotland or Northern Ireland or Wales. I think one of the possible concerns is even though there will be money undoubtedly still flowing through the Arts Council at some rate or other, there's a slightly worrying tendency that possibly some of that money might start to be routed through major organisations. And I think this could be problematic. At the moment, some of the funding which is maybe going direct through the Arts Council may well be spent through NPOs, which are, what are they? National Portfolio Organisations. That's kind of right. So that's a bit of concern, because then issues of taste, of priorities of different organisations start to kick in, and you get, if you like, not as a level as playing field as maybe you had before. Talk a little bit about trusts and foundations. I mean, that trusts and foundations have obviously, over the last 15, 20 years, have become major players in terms of arts funding and so forth. And a lot of, I mean, to their credit, quite a number of trusts and foundations do have schemes that benefit artists. Slightly on the downside of that is that they're becoming more strategic, and that might be an odd thing to say, but I mean, I quite miss the days when there were these bonkers trusts that only funded things within 4 miles of Angel Tube Station or something rather like that. And they seem to have been merged into bigger ones and so forth. And I think kind of miss those a bit. And they do tend to hunt in packs a little bit. So there's not an enormous amount of diversity between what the different trusts spend their money on and so forth. Another point is, and something we don't often talk about, I think, in the arts, is that we all know about what's happening with social mobility on a wider level in terms of society. And I think we're beginning to see some signs that social mobility within our world is actually on the decrease. There's a great kind of little example from last year where somebody analysed the pop music charts, and they found out that in October 2010, 60% of the acts in the charts came from public schools, whereas in October 1990, only 1% of people in the charts came from public schools. And I think that's obviously a kind of not a particularly rigorous piece of research, but you can just start to see it around. I mean, I do quite a lot of work with the BBC, and the BBC, although it's completely anecdotal, the BBC seems to be getting much posher somehow or other again. It feels like almost like going back 20 or 30 years. And although that's something we can't do much about as individuals, I think we need to be aware of this, because in some other countries, to some extent in the States, there's beginning to be a bit of a debate about who the people are who work in the arts. And I think we need to, in a sense, be self-critical, but we also need to be aware of the fact that we are primarily a fairly posh profession. Okay. Obviously, a lot of artists work across both public and commercial sectors. And I'm sure I don't need to tell anybody who's working in the commercial sector that if you try to get any credit, you can't. If you try to get investment, it's very, very difficult. And I think the creative sector's traditionally seen as being the Cinderella sector in terms of the economy. Very high risk for investors and so forth. But that's not true. And there's a very interesting publication last week by the think tank Demos, which you can download for free from their site, which is called Risky Business, and actually shows that, in fact, the creative sector is no more risky than the more general economy and so forth. So it's worth certainly having a look at it, look at the executive summary, And next time you go into a room with a bank manager or investor, use it against them, I think. And if they don't listen, hit them over the head with it or something like that. But it's interesting. I mean, we are seen as being much more risky than in fact we are as an industry. The commercial art market usually booms in a recession and certainly looks like it probably will again this time. And in fact, there's a school of thought that actually sees record-setting auction prices as being a leading indicator of wider economic collapse. There's a great, very funny article on a website called The Atlantic, which is like an online magazine, which has tracked Sotheby's auction prices against the performance of the economy. And it goes in completely in the opposite direction. So I think, you know, if auction prices carry on going up, we're all in trouble, I think. And obviously, there are plenty of artists and art collectors in the Sunday Times rich list, even though I didn't really want to pay Rupert Murdoch £1 to find out who they were. But we know this is not the reality for most artists. So, you know, some of the background noise to what we might be going through or you might be going through as artists and so forth is the fact that, you know, prices are going up and so forth and all this kind of stuff. Lastly, in terms of context, it's probably just having a quick look at the education sector. We know that many artists make all or most of their living by teaching of some kind or by accessing research funds from the Arts and Humanities Research Council. Creative Partnerships, which was a scheme that the Arts Council set up initially with the Education Department, that's gone and so forth. And I'd be very surprised if Arts and Humanities Research funding holds up in the coming period. So right through the system, from postgraduate to arts and humanities, they're all becoming systematically marginalised. And apart from being massively stupid and not looking to the future, this is going to cause some real issues, I think, for artists who supplement their income through teaching or whatever, or sessional work and so forth. So it's a real worry. And then yet again, I'm just editing a book at the moment, and one of the contributors saying we do not want to see, if you like, this area of the arts being inhabited only by rich cherubs, he called them, which I think is quite a nice expression. And I think similarly, I mean, as Jelaine said about Bob, I mean, we, in a sense, artists need to be engaged with the debates about education as well and be seen to be engaged with those debates because they are fundamental both to survival of the short term, but really fundamental to our whole world thriving. Okay, so that's all the bad news. Let's look at some possible strategies and so forth. One of the things that I felt for a long time about the visual arts in particular is that most artists who operate are below the VAT registration threshold. So effectively, in terms of economic planning, in terms of policy and so forth, nobody knows you're there. So in a sense, people do not understand what, if you like, the sector's made up of, what people who work in it, what artists do, what their lives are like, how much they spend, how much they earn and so forth as well. Now, to some extent, obviously, things to do. Are any MyCake users in the room? Anyone use MyCake? Does anybody know about MyCake? Okay. Well, MyCake is quite interesting because it's an accounting package for artists, which is, I think, is charged for at the moment. And correct me if I'm wrong, Russell, because I think you know more about it than I do. But what it does also, as well as actually providing a really easy-to-use accounting package that artists can use to actually do their books on, it also starts pulling out benchmark data. So the more people who sign up for it, obviously anonymously, it doesn't kind of shop you to the tax man or anything like that, but it starts to pull out a really quite a good picture of what people at that lower level of income, which we know most artists operate at, are doing. And it just starts to provide some information. It starts to make that the world that a lot of people live in visible to the outside. Because at the moment, a lot of planning in terms of culture is of SMEs and small companies and so forth. But really, there's not a lot of understanding about what individual sole traders, artists and so forth do. And I'm not saying that's the only one that's out there, but I think there's a need for that kind of initiative, which starts to actually say, okay, we're not just struggling artists in inverted commas. We've got a business, actually. We're doing stuff and so forth, and we need to make some noise about that. I think also it's actually in a certain way, to kind of show that actually you're a business. I mean, if you've got the stomach for it, go along to your local chamber of commerce with a friend or with some other artists or whatever. Don't go by yourself, actually. It'd be terrible. But go along and just actually stake your claim, saying, okay, we're in this borough, in this region, we're working, we are businesses as well. We want our, if you like, our interests, our needs represented and so forth. It's a very alien kind of territory for a lot of people, but it's something that in some parts of the country has actually come up with some really interesting results. Very aware, I think, that what works for artist A will not work for maker B and so forth as well. So it's difficult to make generalizations. It depends on the media people work in. It depends on what kind of person you are. It depends on the resources you have available and so forth. But I want to talk about assets, the kind of publicity that started talking about assets. And I think traditionally, we think about assets as being artworks, in a sense. That, you know, that's what we've got, that's what we make. We make artworks, we make objects and so forth, or whatever we do. But I think we need to start thinking much more widely about what an asset is. And I would say that actually increasing an asset is everything about you, actually, and everything about the people who like what you do as well. It's extending that notion of what constitutes an individual artist as much as possible. It's kind of like looking towards making a kind of hinterland around your work. And what that does is it gives people more opportunity to connect with you. So, I mean, people can obviously find your work on a database or find it on a website and so forth as well. But just sometimes, just telling some of that backstory yourself can give people other ways of connecting. I mean, I work now probably more with music than I do with the visual arts, and that's been an incredibly successful, not so much a strategy, actually, because it's come out of how people are. But it just puts you in a different kind of position. It gives people opportunity to kind of connect with what you're up to. And I'm not talking about social networking here. I'm talking about something a bit more meaningful than that, and something, you know, it's your ideas, it's your values, it's what you think about the world and so forth. Fellow speakers here are great examples of that in terms of their online presence. I mean, Julaine's already mentioned Bob's great letter to Michael Gove and so forth. And that just kind of, even if I didn't like his work, I'd love him just for the letter. Luckily, I do like his work as well. And there's some great examples in music in terms of, I mean, there's an artist actually who's appearing at Cut and Splice, which is a festival at the ICA at the beginning of November, called Jennifer Walsh. And she, in a sense, has created a whole kind of story around what she does. I mean, she's actually not only created a persona for herself, she's created an entirely fake art collective of which she's the only member, and she has about 7 personas in it, all of whom are appearing at the ICA at different times and so forth. There's an American composer called John Zorn who I'm interested in. I like his music, but I also I'm interested by what he's got to say about Jewish culture. I'm interested about what he says about making music for particular kind of communities and so forth. So it gives me more than just one way of connecting with his work, and I think that's something which is not as familiar, in a sense. We see quite a lot of online presence, which is a biography, some pictures of your work, and contact details and so forth. And I think there's more ways, online and offline, in engaging more widely. Increasingly, I think this is not about marketing. It's about place in the world, and it's about trying to connect with people emotionally and intellectually, as well as collecting them as people who are interested in art. How does this help make a living? Well, it gives more people opportunities to come across your work, more opportunities to kind of like what you're doing, more opportunities to kind of get interested in you, I guess, as well. In one of the previous, I'm not sure it was a debate in this series, but one of the previous events, Paul Bennon talked about the world remaining pretty much the same for commercially successful artists. The gallery system really as an industrial model is like something out of the 17th century, never mind the 21st century, but being very different for everybody else. And right now there's obviously a lot of attention towards selling work online, and it'd be interesting to know what people's experience here has been of that as well. I mean, my impression is it works for some people, but it doesn't work for others. Possibly over a longer period of time it could become very significant, but it's not clear at the moment whether this is going to be a major part of our world and so forth. None of the platforms seem to quite work for me at the moment. They seem to fall somewhere between kind of quasi-shopping and not a very good way of looking at art, and they just don't seem to inspire me for some reason. But it'd be interesting to hear what people think about that. Next, there's some new forms of philanthropy. I mean, we all know about, in a sense, the single philanthropists, but there are beginning to be some initiatives which are looking towards things like crowdfunding, ways of actually groups of people getting associated with a particular project or a particular kind of artist and so forth, and getting behind them and supporting them. And there's a relatively new site called WeDidThis.org. Do people know about WeDidThis? Check it out. It's quite interesting, actually. And I've been looking at it for a couple of weeks, actually, just going through and seeing what's working and what's not working on there. And there's been some really quite successful fundraising strategies on there. A young artist who wanted to set up an exhibition in Istanbul and also document that exhibition. She raised all the money she required by just putting details of her project online. But another artist who seemed to have on paper or on screen what looked like a very similar project, didn't manage to raise anything at all. So I think, again, it's going to be a bit like the online environment. It'll work, but for some people it won't work for others. But it's an interesting new form, and I think it'll take a while for people to get used to it in this country. It's much more used by the third sector, the voluntary sector in the States, than it is here. But it could be quite significant for some artists, but maybe not for others as well. Maybe we can circulate some of these websites later on, actually, as well. I'm going to use a couple of examples from the music world that I'm working in at the moment, which I think could have some resonance for the visual arts at the next point, to illustrate the next point. Firstly, I work with an experimental record label, and we had a meeting last week. I've been going for quite a long time. Had a meeting last week, and we were just looking at what's happening in terms of their kind of sales and so forth. And what was really interesting was that licensing, they'd never been particularly pursuing licensing opportunities for their sound, and it is mostly sound, it's not music, I'm not talking about tunes here. And all of a sudden, in a very short period of time, just by one or two opportunities, the licensing has gone up very, very rapidly. Things have been used in games as atmospheres, things have been used in TV programs, things have been used in theatre productions and dance productions and so forth. And it just seems to be growing very, very fast. And one of the things about it, it's interesting about this, is in a sense they haven't really pursued this very much, but it's beginning to become a very significant part of their income. And it's not impossible to imagine that this could actually overtake physical sales of stuff to people, if you like, over a period of time. And just related to that, secondly, a young former colleague of mine is about to start a freelance life, connecting up his extensive knowledge of music with funding opportunities and finding opportunities for licensing and placement in visual and other sound media and so forth. And he's been doing his homework. He's been talking to a lot of people working in this area. And they're saying, in a sense, well, it's one thing to have a database or one thing to have a library, if you like, of images or sounds or whatever, but somebody needs to be out there kind of joining, finding those opportunities, because people will search for stuff and they'll find stuff, but most of the licensing opportunities come out of conversations that are had. So it's not just about a database. So somebody needs to be in a room talking to an art director or a production company or whatever. And it seems to me that, you know, it's not time to invent a new profession in a recession, but it seems to me that this is a role that people could usefully play. It might be curators, it might be artists and so forth. But people who have got a lot of information, a lot of passion for particular areas of, quite niche areas if necessary in terms of visual arts, out there trying to get themselves in front of people who are licensing material. And I know that DAX are thinking in this area a bit for the future as well. But my feeling is this is part of the future. I know people, I'm sure there are people here who've had material license and so forth, but it's that thing about being proactive, and it's that thing about being trying to get into those conversations that are had in rooms, actually. It's not about it's not just about what happens online. And it's about trust there as well. I mean, in a sense, obviously the artist needs to trust whoever's out there doing that for them, but in a sense, the person who's doing the licensing also needs the trust that the person having the conversation with him is going to come up with the right kind of solution for whatever they're doing, their game or their TV series and so forth. But also the person who's out there needs to understand, if you like, what the values of that artist are, where they will go and where they won't go in terms of what kind of relationships they had. A lot of what I've been saying is about connectedness, really. And another example, really, is there's been some interesting initiatives recently of artists making very, very strong connections outside of the world of the arts. Stuart Semple's recent exhibition at the Old Vic, curated exhibition at the Old Vic with Mind is a good example of that. I mean, in a sense, it was a show, it was partly a fundraising show for Mind, but it also was a show about mental health issues and so forth. And even though he, you know, in a sense, that was a single exhibition, that was opening up contemporary art, it was opening up possibilities probably to a whole load of mental health professionals who may not normally go into a gallery space. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if one or two of them went away and started thinking about either commissioning work for a mental health setting or actually working with an artist in a different kind of way. Again, it extends that kind of basis. I know a lot of people are active in this already, so it's not a kind of new idea in a sense, but it's something that seems to be very kind of beneficial and possibly very, very powerful. So The marketplace of where it is, you may, you know, somebody may hit lucky and the work is spotted by a dealer, gallery, or arts institution. And if you do, there's obviously, you know, there's a reasonably well-trodden career path ahead of you if that happens. But that's not going to happen to everybody, as we well know. So things are going to be difficult, but it's very important to use resources out there. One of the other things I'm quite aware of is that we've got a lot of information out there. You know, the ArtQuest site's actually packed with stuff. I spent an hour on it last week, actually. Same with DAX, same with Contemporary Art Society and so forth. But there needs to be a kind of real incentive to actually get hold of that information in a way which is kind of meaningful to people, I think. It's also strength in numbers, I think. I mean, it's kind of... we've seen plenty of times where there have been art movements which have brought together artists who have like different practices and different approaches, but actually make some common cause. And I think, you know, we are probably in that kind of time again, where actually working with other people, finding new ways, if you like, of pulling together, not just for campaigning, not just in the sense, but actually new ways of actually kind of looking at how to work, how to find new models for working and so forth. You know, elsewhere outside of the arts, there are people doing all kinds of things in terms of new models of social enterprise, people doing all kinds of things to change the supply chain for whatever kind of work they're working in. Ways of bundling together risky and less risky projects into packages and trying to get people to either fund them or invest in them. And I think this notion of actually everybody having to make their own pitch, if you like, is one that can be cut through by actually working together and presenting, if you like, a portfolio of projects to a funder, which include things which are, if you like, safe bets and things that aren't and so forth. It's quite an unusual way of working for artists to do that, and I think there's some real potential in there to get some results, actually. And if there aren't any models out there which already exist, make one up. You know, I mean, I'm working at the moment with a project in Northern Ireland, which is supposedly doing two different things. One's working with young parents. It's a website working with young parents, and it's an idea sharing thing. It's got a very low subscription level. And another one's about music, and it's about advice to individual musicians and small music organisations. And in a weird kind of way, they're beginning to blur, actually. And the musicians who are parents are actually finding they've got quite a lot of interesting things to say to each other. So, you know, who knows? Maybe it's about artists with children. Maybe it's about artists who don't live in East or South East London and so forth. You know, new ways of networking, new ways of putting together communities of interest and so forth. Now, I haven't used the word social networking very much, and I'm increasingly aware that as useful as all these platforms can be, they can also be a bit illusory as well. I had an email exchange with a friend a couple of weeks ago, and she said, well, so we meet up sometime, it'd be great to meet up. So there's a big exchange of, I said, well, it seems like you're all over the place. You're probably too famous and too busy to even meet me. And she said, well, it's not quite like that, actually. So I think, you know, the danger is that sometimes some of the social platforms can give an impression of connectedness, which actually, when it comes to, if you like, closing the deal or doing the deal, isn't really there. And I think we've all got probably hundreds of friends on Facebook and whatever, but it doesn't necessarily mean that things are all going in the right direction. So the thing is about social networking, but possibly on a different kind of level, things that actually have some kind of outcome, some things that have some kind of payoff and so forth. Also, I think there's a need to in a recession, at a time of crisis, there's a real need to reevaluate and if you like, co-mentor each other. Be critical, actually, you know, not just in a sense worry by yourself. In a sense, worry with others, actually. You know, you can probably bring something to bear on somebody else's practice, how they run their business and so forth. And the whole notion of kind of, you know, support is one thing, but also that thing about being quite critical, that sharing ideas about different things that work for you or may work for somebody else and so forth. I mean, it's a no-brainer to say this, but it's quite an important thing to do. And, you know, obviously use the organisations that are there, but do it on a more informal basis and so forth. Because in a way, that's, you know, that it's going to be probably more likely to be together than by ourselves that this thing's going to work in the future, especially with what might be coming up for the next generation and so forth. So, of course, everyone's going to drop everything, and you know, if they get a call from Jay Jopling or something or other, or a teaching tenure post in the university, but that's not going to happen to everybody. So I think it's probably important to actually get some kind of solidarity and work together. That's it, really, in terms of thinking about some of the possible models of the way forward. I'm not sure how much time I've taken up. Thank you.
Thank you, John. John's painted a picture really of the limits and constraints that potentially the current economic situation gives rise to, but also the opportunities for new relationships, networks, and connections that this crisis could potentially open up. So I'm going to turn now to Bob to respond in the first instance and to give his perspectives as an artist to some of the things that John has said.
Okay. I think I'm going to respond by having a list of reasons to be pessimistic and reasons to be cheerful, much in the same way that you outlined the kind of in your keynote address, I suppose. But I do think there are a couple of things to really understand about the present government. One is there is a fundamental shift away from the post-war kind of idea of consensus, in that we would kind of emancipate people via the Arts Council by bringing them theatre and art and all of the things we've enjoyed in this period, and that has ended, and we have to oppose it, and it has to. So that is a kind of pessimistic tone on which to start, but it does need opposing. The Brown Review into higher education, with its £9,000 fee, will mean that people like myself, maybe yourself, will not go to university. The effect of it is really damaging. It means that all of the art schools in London are coagulating in order so they can become a big institution, so that they can attract overseas students who will be the only people in 5 years' time who will go to those institutions. And that effect of that change is reflected in, I mean, this is unbelievable, in primary and secondary education, where Michael Gove is, with his EBAC, English Baccalaureate, is proposing to remove art from the national curriculum. And so that will... And that has already meant the closure of Roehampton PGCE course. So there won't be any art qualified art teachers. There'll just be teaching assistants teaching. And that has impact on generations of people who think that, well, actually, I can have a diverse economy in my life, like I have had. I've enjoyed. I've never made a lot of money from teaching. I've never made a lot of money from selling art. And I've never made much money from doing public art projects. But those three things together have meant that I've been able to continue being an artist. All that is under threat. And the broader scheme of things means that we have to think about whose culture is it. We are all cultural beings. Everything is made. Everything is designed. Everything is thought about by human beings. We are sitting in an amazing building, which is a conversation between people who want to change the world, who constructed Conway Hall. We have to think that that conversation is really important, and everybody needs to be involved in it. And it means that it means essentially that the kind of jobs in the arts have to be inspected. Because I know that lots of my friends say, oh, it's great to have a job at DAX or maybe ArtQuest or something, but that means that they won't be an artist. They'll be organising the lives of some other artist, and they'll be doing it one day a week, or whatever it is, you see. And so that means that who will then be the artists of the future? And of course, we know that culture is something that we all share, but if we're not careful, culture shifts away from us, and it becomes something that we visit rather than that we participate in and make. So we have to think very fundamentally, very politically, and think that actually what we have to do is say we want the things that we want. We think that it's important politically because we're all human beings and we want to participate within culture in our many and various ways. It doesn't mean we all want to show at Freeze Art Fair or something, but it does mean that we all want to kind of participate in this world and celebrate each other, each other's creativity. So that's the kind of fundamentally depressing story I have for you. And the man in the government who's organising this fantastic review, actually, of culture for Michael Gove is Darren Henley, the chief executive of Classic FM, for goodness sake, which is only very barely a music station. You know, it's essentially, but it is a fantastic model for the arts, because it's a model in which there is a short snippet of something that you've heard a million times before, and then followed by a series of adverts. And that will be the model for education. And I actually enjoy the Freeze Art Fair. I love it. I think it's fun to go there. I usually blag my... I've never had a legitimate ticket to go into it. But I enjoy it. But I don't want to see the NHS or our universities or schools constructed on that model. Also, the government says to us that philanthropy is a good thing. And of course, philanthropy is a good thing. But the problem is that it transfers power away from public institutions and distorts their mission and persuades them to behave like private institutions. So there's problems there as well. So it's all a bit grim, really. But there are some reasons to be cheerful. And one reason to be cheerful is all the people protesting at St. Paul's. And the other is last week I was in New York, and the St. Paul's, the Wall Street protests, they have a whole heap of performance art and creative food going on at these Wall Street protests where I went down last week. And at St. Paul's, it's an incredibly kind of creative environment. And one of the things that will happen, and it won't be my generation of artists, because my generation of artists turned the utopian visions of people like Susan Hiller and Bill Colbert and Helen Chadwick, nicked all their ideas and turned it into cash. That's what my generation of British artists did. But the next generation of artists will be inspired by the people, by this wave of incredibly peaceful and creative protest, and we will actually have, and we haven't had a decent counterculture in this country since rave, and it is quite exciting because it does look like that's appearing, a kind of genuine upsurge of sort of manifestations. I'm wondering what the stimulants of the new counterculture will be. So I think there are some things to think. Actually, it is an incredibly exciting time. But it's also a very fundamentally depressing time, and we need to realise that, become creative, and oppose all these things. And there is one last point which highlights the complete stupidity of the government, is that that Apple has more money sloshing around than the US government at the moment. Why is that? It's because Jonathan Ives went to St. Martin's Art School, studied art and industrial design. He was patronised when he came up with a design for some taps in Hull by somebody with a kind of crazy red nose, and that person could well be Michael Gove. And Jonathan Ives went and left and worked for Apple, and he has constructed this world that Apple live in. And that has come out of British education. It's come out of that emancipatory post-war period. And so the government, even on its own terms, Britain is, the brand of Britain is cultural, it's visual, it's musical. And even on their own terms, in terms of business, they're doing something which is utterly stupid.
Thank you, Bob. I'm going to turn now to Zeynep.
I want to start with this kind of idea of, you know, British artists of being based in the UK and, you know, like me, for example, and the cuts, obviously, and the crisis here. But when you're not, there are also artists, I guess, like me, and there are many more than me in this situation who has other connections. One of my connections is obviously France, where I do a lot of work there. And then another one, which is a kind of, it's a bigger region, but nevertheless, I've done a lot of work with them. It's the Middle East, and I'm sure that the crisis, the economical crisis in the Middle East is very different from the one here in France. So I'm gonna, you know, I want to talk about my experience really. I've never been like you, Bob. I've never been an artist who sold a lot purely because I do a lot of video work, and we know this doesn't sell, especially when you do kind of multi-screen installation and blah blah blah. So I don't really sell to private collectors, a bit too kind of institution. I'm told I'm an institutionalized artist. That's what I'm called, rather than a private collector artist. Therefore, it means I do sell every now and then, but probably not as much as others. So that's one thing. The other thing, I don't teach. I've been lucky up to now to not do any teaching, but that doesn't mean that I've got a lot of money, just because, I just wouldn't enjoy, and I don't want to teach. That's just the way it is. So if I had to find seek another job, I would try to seek something else, I think, rather than teaching, just because I don't believe I'll be a good teacher, as simple as that. But I've been lucky over the last few years, and it's been quite constant, is that I've been commissioned for some quite important piece of work. And because of that, I've been managing to kind of claim or ask for some artist fee. And then instead of teaching, perhaps the money I live on, it's this artist fee. And experience and maturity has kind of taught me to claim for those fees, because sometimes you are not really offered. But as an artist, you need to ask them, you know, or build it into the commission budget. So that's my way of kind of making money in some ways. And then also trying to save money in other places. Like, for example, I don't have a studio like many, many artists. I do have a small room in my flat where I work from. And as a video artist, perhaps I do not need a studio space in the same way than other artists. So I'm saving money there, really. Then just kind of trying to find different ways of going around. And going back also to the work I do with the Middle East, I'm kind of quite perhaps lucky, and I don't know how long it's going to last, and I hope it's going to last for some time now, is that I do get commissioned by, you know, the Qatari government or, you know, or in Dubai, etc. And usually it comes with, you know, fairly good money. So I do have those other kind of places like France or the Middle East and England, obviously, where I kind of make some work for. I'm just looking at my notes. I mean, obviously, I do also a lot of talks, artist talks, which is something I really enjoy, and I do them, you know, in the UK, but also a bit everywhere, really, depending on where the demand comes from. So I don't make a huge amount of money, but I'm kind of up to now managed to live just about. But I do think more and more now, and that started, I guess, 2-3 years ago, I'm starting to think of the future about, you know, if the sales stops and if the commission stops, what will happen? You know, what will happen to me? Would I have to go into teaching? Would I have to actually drop out altogether? I also have a family, so it's always in my mind, you know, how do you raise money and how do you, how do you kind of look after the children, really? So that's my experience, really. I don't really feel the kind of the cuts, really, in the art yet. But sometimes I think it's because I do a lot of work outside the UK, and it's probably why. France probably has as bad as a financial crisis as here. But again, because I don't live in France and I do work punctually with few institutions there, I don't seem to kind of really feel the effect yet. So this is really my contribution.
Thank you, Zeynep. Something that connects what all three of you have been talking about is this sense that perhaps one of the outcomes of the current crisis is a diminution of diversity and difference, and that by losing that, we're not just going to lose financial opportunities for artists, but we're also actually going to lose a space where things become possible, which can generate value, generate wealth, but also generate opportunities and new ideas and new ways of thinking and being. And it strikes me that one of the challenges that we have, given the challenge, the post-war consensus that Bob talked about, is how we can sustain this difference and the quality that artists bring to culture and society by the very fact of not being part of an established system and way of operating as the rest of society, that actually that creates opportunities and openings which society doesn't really know about until they start to emerge and become visible. John, you talked about this question of visibility and how that's so important. And in a way, perhaps one of the things wrong with the post-war consensus is that we haven't been visible or talked enough about what those opportunities and what those openings are that have been seeded by educational opportunities, by support for artists, by the public sector, and so on. John, do you?
Yeah, I think it probably started to happen before the recession. Actually, there seemed to be like a, and it's very hard to put your kind of finger on it really, there seemed to be a bit of a kind of closing down going on. I mean, not just in the visual arts, but across the board. I mean, I worked for a while for Sound and Music, a experimental music organisation, and we used to play a game of actually guessing what was going to be in a festival that was coming up and getting about 90% of it right. And I think there has been a certain amount of homogeneity kind of creeping into a lot of, and probably it is about institutions actually being quite well-funded, actually, and quite kind of sure of themselves, and therefore quite sure of their kind of tastes and so forth. And I think the danger is that this will accelerate with there being less money around, and increasingly it'll be opportunities closing down. I think also, this will probably get me booed off, actually, I think in a way, I mean, Bob did a fantastic demolition of the YBAs there. It was absolutely brilliant, really. But I think there's been a bit of a me thing going on with the visual arts as well. And that hasn't helped, in a sense. It's always been look at me and kind of on a grate and so forth as well. Not, you know, across the arts and so forth. And I think there's not been a lot of people, if you like, consciously kind of bringing other people into the mix, established artists and so forth, in a sense. Sorry, I'm too far away from the mic, I think. So I think there's been a little bit of that. And it's interesting, we've just been doing some interviews for this book that's coming out in a while. And somebody from the commercial sector, something running the biggest live entertainment organisation in the world, said the trouble with the arts is they don't give anything back. And I thought, this is a really odd comment coming from somebody in the commercial sector. He backed it up fairly vigorously, saying, you know, it's all about getting more money for your organisation or yourself and so forth. Interesting. It made me think about that a bit, I think.
Zeynep, you talked about connections, and I'm wondering whether, and John, a lot of your discussion was about the opportunities were through connections, and implicitly you too, Bob. I wonder if the fact that the institutions are becoming less homogenous and certain things are closing down doesn't create some opportunities for new kinds of networks and connectivities which actually cut out the institutions, and whether that could be an opportunity in the sense that you know, if those institutions are showing the same thing over and over again and people are looking for something else, whether that creates an opportunity as a counterculture, as the demonstrations are showing in St. Paul's and on Wall Street, that actually by closing something down, you actually offer another opportunity for different voices to be articulated.
Cheers up to me. Well, I think one can be a bit romantic about it. I mean, I think the reason why people are protesting is because they're angry and worried and scared. And if one thinks, oh, that could be immensely creative, I think I think that's true, but it's also grim. And I don't think they should feel that they should be having to do that. I think one of the things that I was thinking about very much this summer is that I'm doing a show in New York in November, and I was in New York over the summer making this show. And one of the things that's very exciting about America which a lot of people on the left don't really understand, is that after 9/11, they elected Barack Obama. And on the left, everybody's kind of very, you know, kind of upset with Barack Obama because the expectations were so crazily high. But one of the things that that government has managed to do, which our government hasn't done, is it hasn't run the American economy based on the idea that we're gonna butcher everything and have deficit reduction as the only measure of success within the economy is how big we get the deficit reduction deficit down, because you can't run America, you can't run austerity America in the way that our stupid government think that we can romantically summon up austerity Britain, and because it's too depressing. And what we have in our country is a very depressing government. It offers no hope. And Michelle Obama has written this fantastic book, a series of texts about the importance of creativity in the economy. And as creative people, we need to say to the government that actually you need to offer people hope. And actually art and culture and creativity does that as much as it creates, you know, is helpful to the economy. It offers people a way forward. I mean, I know for years I worked as a removal man, and the only thing that actually kept me together was the idea that I was somehow participating in this world of art somehow, although I wasn't really, but I thought I was. And so this idea that somehow, you know, art provides a strand, you know, it does provide ladders and provides, you know, it's what you're talking about social mobility. It's very important not to create mobility for the middle class to move up into the upper class, but to provide ladders for kids to think, oh, I can participate in this world of ideas. And I think perhaps the idea of the protesters is saying, well, actually, I want to participate in grown-up culture, but the only way I can do it is sit outside St. Paul's because you're not interested in me. And so I think it's a very double-edged thing. It's very nuanced, but I do think this, you know, it won't be my generation who sort out the problems of the world, you know, in terms of the economy. It will be the generation below mine and the below that who will do that. So I think that, you know, I think there is incredible hope in that kind of creativity, but it's a bit painful, you know, it's really painful.
John also talked about this notion of collective, and Zeynep, you mentioned artist fees, something, you know, which increasingly at DAX we, you know, hear stories about how artists find it increasingly difficult to make demands for fees, worried that they won't get included, or that if they're too vocal somehow that will work against them. And for the first time, I think, in a very long time, there are conversations going on between artists about artists' unions. And I wonder if you see any potential in collective action, direct action by artists, as being something which could potentially create both collective action and actual real benefits.
I mean, for me, one of the action that when I, you know, when I speak to younger artists, or, you know, artists who just finished, you know, colleges and things, I always say, you know, the more we do all arts for free, the more we're likely to get them. And after having done all those, you know, shows in different places, I can really realize that the UK is very, very particular in terms of giving fee. I should say very stingy, because you always have to demand, and often you say no. As other places, like in America, I've noticed the experience I've got, like often you don't ask and they give you. It's automatical, you know. You're doing a show, even a group show, and you're given, you know, you get a contract with your fee. In England, no, you have to ask for it, you know, because I always hope you won't ask, and then they'll save that on you. And it even happened sometimes to me that I ended up in group shows where some artists had some fees and others didn't. Or some did that per DM, and others didn't. because some did ask and others didn't, and that creates a kind of, and I always say, you know, we must all ask for fee because we should get, after all, you know, we have to take it like it's a job for me when I go and exhibit, even in a group show, it's a job. I'm spending time, you know, doing that, installing and etc. And I want to be paid for that, you know.
But you're making an argument for collective action because everyone's acting as individuals, negotiating their own deal. Surely if there was a consensus and a collective
Obviously, yes, but I still think that if we were all doing that, there is a point where the curators and the administrators, etc., in this institution, we actually realize that it's not on, you know, it can't go on. Whereby that we always hope that the artists will be silent. And they're playing on the fact that, yes, young artists are worried. They think if I ask for a fee, I'm not going to be included in the show, you know. And,
I wonder if we could talk a bit about philanthropy, because Bob, you mentioned it, and John brought up some models of philanthropy which are not the ones of the private collector extending patronage. Call that patronage rather than philanthropy, but actually of more crowdfunding, and where, you know, you put out your projects out there. Certainly in film it's taking off, not so many examples in the visual arts, but where you put out your work there and people donate, sometimes small amounts, but if sufficient numbers of people donate, that can be sufficient to fund a project. And I wonder if, as is likely to happen, commissions are on the decrease. And if you're not an artist, as you said, Zeynep, who's not a private collector artist, whether you think there's any potential in the philanthropy, the mass philanthropy model, if you like, that has potential for artists.
I'm a bit of an odd character in that I've only ever once applied for public money for a project, and I got, after hopping through endless bureaucracy, I did get this money, and I was very grateful for it, but I slightly felt a bit guilty and weird about it, and so I've tried to avoid that, really, and tried to sell things in order to fund what I do, really, because I think that somehow, I don't really want to be robbing the taxpayer more than I have to, but I do think there are interesting things about philanthropy which are really problematic for institutions. One is collectors, museums that show collectors' collections instead of running their own program. I think that's really distorting of what the public money for museums is for. And that's an incredibly problematic area, because of course we want to see art, and actually we do want to see private collectors' collections in the public realm. But I don't think we ought to be paying for that to happen in quite the way that sometimes we are. And I think they ought to be paying for it to make their work public. And then the other thing to say also is quite interesting with White Cube opening its new space in Bermondsey. It has, I mean, I haven't visited it yet, but apparently it is a huge, fantastic, monolithic space, a wonderful space for showing art. And so lots of people at Tate are saying, my God, you know, what does this mean for public institutions? You know, if these private institutions can build buildings much bigger than, you know, Chisenhale Gallery or Gasworks or something, what does it mean if you know, this institution constructs this thing? And one thing I would say that it means is that those institutions like Gagosian and White Cube, the validity for art is somehow about the audience for it. The audience for the big public institutions in this country is growing, and it's huge. And I can tell you that at White Cube, there will not be 4.5 million people traipsing through it. So actually the public realm, it's about the public realm, and that's a very important thing for artists to realise, that their authority, the authority of art, exists through this conversation that we can all have, not the conversation that the elite can have. It's meaningless. The conversation that we can all have within the public realm is something to really celebrate, and that's one of the things that we ought to be kind of fighting for and building up and celebrating is the things that happen within the public space.
So does that mean there's no opportunity, and I come back to John, about the idea of artists engaging in conversations with audiences directly? Are those things mutually exclusive, the idea of the conversation that happens via the public institution between an artist and its and your public, and the idea that John was putting forward about the possibility of engaging directly with your audiences unmediated, using online and offline?
I think it's both, actually. I mean, I think, you know, I completely agree with Bob about the importance of public institutions and that kind of level of engagement. And I should declare an interest. I am an advisor to the Tate on an occasional basis. But I think the direct things are really important as well. And in fact, the two things can actually work together very effectively. Again, there are plenty of examples outside of the visual arts where that's happening. So I think it's both, actually. I don't think it's probably sensible for anybody to expect public institutions to have their conversation for them with the public. I mean, in a sense, there needs to be direct routes in there as well.
Okay, I think it's time that I open this up to the floor and gathered some questions, comments, opinion on some of the things that have been said. Okay, there's a gentleman who I recognise right at the back of the hall. So if we could take the microphone to... And if you could identify yourself, please, and say what your main occupation is.
My name is Klaus and I'm a visual artist. I guess this is a general comment and also a question to all of you on the panel. So one thing I couldn't help notice was that you all talk about how different institutions and society and the commercial sector all being compiled in these huge mega corporations, mega art corporations, mega educational corporations. And it's kind of almost like, yeah, we arrived at the way the sci-fi films looked in the 70s and 80s. And welcome to the future. As an artist, you're not on the board level, so gaining access to those big institutions can be quite difficult. And, you know, it's almost as if, you know, how do you make enough noise to reach that high? That's one of the concerns about spreading out too much. I guess the other question I had was about if you take that premise that you do have these very, very big institutions, and then you have artists that run their businesses as artists and not as a business. So in a provocative way, isn't the answer that the artist needs to run a business and not an artist? And if we give a few examples of very successful artists, they run themselves as a business. And, you know, what comments do you have to that?
So the first question is, how do you get heard? And the second is, if you're an artist and not a business, how do you actually manage to be successful commercially?
Well, you know, I would say to be heard, really, you have to work and keep working until they hear you, you know. Obviously, depending on the artist and the situation, people get heard in different ways, perhaps. My experience is probably very different from Bob's one. So, you know, I will always advise, you know, to artists when they ask me, because this question is asked sometimes to me, and then I will just say, you know, keep working, and as long as you work, there will be at one point some kind of, I hope, recognition, but perhaps it's totally naive, perhaps it's much more complicated than that, and the competition is very fierce in the UK also in terms of the amount of practicing artists that are around, so I'm not sure, really.
Well, I agree with what you're saying, actually. I think about the idea of the business of it, you know, and the kind of popularism of trying to make something and trying to sell it. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's fantastic. And this afternoon, actually, I mean, he's a funny artist, but this afternoon I took my students to see this fantastic gallery called Red Gallery, where they had this great show of all these different artists who've been working in the East End in collectives. making things like, I don't know, like Bank and Union Street and all these different things which I know really well and all sort of friends of mine, basically. And it has been a huge community over years, kind of people struggling away trying to make art and keeping it all going, living like paupers. But as we walked there, we walked past Patrick Hughes' studio on Great Eastern Street, which is really funny because he has this shop window, and it literally is a shop window with all his funny pointy sculptures, you know, which have a kind of funny optical thing going on. And he is somebody who's really, you know, sold his wares. And I was saying to them, you know, we're going to go and see one end of the art market now, but we're walking past this. And it's just quite interesting, you know, there are actually lots of different ways of being an artist. There are some very foolish, self-aggrandizing artists who are publicly funded, and there's some very morally righteous, kind of interesting artists who just fund themselves commercially. It doesn't matter. What matters is whether the work is good, whether it resonates with people, and whether it has a kind of veracity and authority. And if you do that, it doesn't matter how you fund yourself. But it's difficult, and things are getting more difficult, is what I suppose what I'm saying.
I think there have been also some many artists who have had, you know, who have been artists and curator, artists and writer, and I think that's probably also another way, perhaps, to kind of get seen, because you've got this other umbrella that might be curating, and many artists, as we know, for many years now have kind of curated shows so to give themselves a visibility, but you know, the fact that they might be able to be writers also and art critics, or you know, as I said earlier, curators, might also give them this kind of visibility that otherwise would be harder to get.
I'm very interested in what you said, Bob and Zuni, which is saying, well, the work sort of speaks for itself, but that seemed to be a bit different from John, what you were saying, and I just wanted to explore that, because at one stage you were saying, well, the artist has to sell themselves more as an artist as opposed to their work. You're saying that the hinterland around the artist, and is that a problem? Because obviously, you know, the critique of the YBAs has been that actually they have, it's more about themselves than it has been about the artwork. So are you proposing art as celebrity culture, or the art is becoming part of celebrity culture as the artist and the artist itself, as opposed to the objectivity of the work?
Absolutely not. No, I wasn't really suggesting that at all. The work's got to be interesting, and the work's got to be engaging. But no, what I was suggesting, in a sense, is that there are ways of giving people slightly more options to engage with it. And it's not about kind of self-publicity and marketing and so forth. It's more about kind of just having. I mean, if you believe in something, and if you have values, and that informs your work, then why not tell people about it really as well? I mean, that's more about that than saying, I'm great, I'm interesting, I'm cool, or whatever. And I think that's where, certainly I'm attracted to artists who do that, in a sense, who tell their backstory a bit as well as actually make good work. But you certainly can't be an interesting artist if your art's no good, really, I think.
Any more questions? There's a question, gentlemen, in the middle there, on the left-hand side. Could you say who you are, please?
Sure. I'm Glenn Adamson. I'm the head of the research department at the Victoria and Albert Museum. And I had a question about intellectual property. And this was, I suppose, prompted by your discussion of licensing, John. And, of course, Dax is a licensing company, among other things. And I suppose my question is about what seems to me to be a conflict between two things that we would all approve of. One, which is getting money to artists via licensing, and the other is perhaps a kind of copyleft attitude to intellectual property in general, and the feeling that it would be quite good if art were to flow around the world freely as possible. Insofar as a visual artwork is an idea in material form, you'd like to think it could get everywhere, you know, Africa, Asia, Latin America, as well as Europe and America. And it seems that in many cases licensing is a way to prevent that kind of flow, whether we like it or not, and I wonder how you both assess those two competing interests.
Well, if I might take that first. First of all, art doesn't flow freely. It's part of a very complex global capital system, and you just need to go to Fries Art Fair to see that those aren't free flows. Those are transactions which
now generate a multi-million pound industry, of whom, you know, of which actually a relatively small amount of that money ends up in the hands of artists, the majority ending up elsewhere. So I think let's not be romantic about flows of art in the world. The other thing is that, you know, as Hugh Locke said recently when he was asked about licensing and fees, he said, how come when exhibitions are mounted or websites are launched, everyone gets paid except me? You know, if you look at the budgets and the way in which the money is distributed for a major exhibition or for a book or for a website, no one challenges the fact that designers earn money, that the people who install the show will be paid. I really don't see why, unless we're harking back to an old 19th century model, which actually is the pre-post-war consensus model, that says that somehow you are of independent means and don't need to be paid, that the artist shouldn't be paid. So I really don't see those things as in conflict. I think it's just a question of ensuring that in an industry which is actually generating multi-millions of pounds, and even in the public sector where I know money's restricted, but nonetheless, you know, you're paid for your job as a researcher, everyone in the institution is paid, I don't see why the artist should be the person, and sometimes it's the curator, I have to say, who's expected to operate on no fee.
This is a really tricky one, I think, actually, because what I suppose my worry is that, in a sense, the visual arts might well go through some of the same pain as the music industry has gone through, in a sense, where you have rights holders and collecting societies, in a sense, fighting a rearguard action against what is seen as being unfair use of, in this case, material, sound material and music material and so forth, while missing out on some of the opportunities that are presented. And I think, in a sense, if there is going to be, and there needs to be a new accommodation, I think, in terms of people who own IP and people who exploit IP with people who want to use it, actually. And I think at the moment, nothing's quite working as it should do. But at the same time as that, there's got to be a way of actually looking at new ways of creating income from it as well. And I think the problem in music was the first was kind of groped towards, and there was a big battle about it, but nobody really thought about finding new ways, in this case of musicians and composers, to make money. So the two things have to run alongside each other. Otherwise, I think there's trouble ahead, really, because it's going to be very difficult to. And I've talked to, and it's interesting, sitting in a room, and I mean, I found myself in a room with the people who are developing Little Big Planet 2. Anyone with kids knows what Little Big Planet is. I mean, it's a Sony PlayStation game. And in a sense, they've now finally, after all this pain, got to a reasonably good accommodation with rights holders about using sound. They were also very proactive about finding new sources, if you like, a material. Whereas, in fact, I asked them towards the end of the meeting, because I knew this was coming up today, saying, do you use original artwork in your films, in a sense? Because you were primarily a visual medium. And they said, it's just too much hassle, and we don't know. You know, if we look at something that's coming, for instance, might be in the Tate collection, there'll be about 40 different kinds of usage that are in place. So there's got to be some kind of proper way of people to understand that externally, I think, to be able to fully exploit it. And, you know, but there's money to be lost out there, to put it really bluntly, but there's also money to be made out there as well, if somebody can sensibly manage this whole process, I think.
Yeah, I think, obviously money in a capitalist economy is made by, buying and selling things. And the tricky things for artists, it's not really made by people who are making things, unfortunately, making those individual items. And it's the same for the, you know, music industry as it is for visual art, making film. How do you extract a living from it? It's a very, very difficult thing. So we need to really actually, you know, kind of work that out. Somehow. I don't know quite what the answer is, but licensing shouldn't be thought of as absolutely evil, because actually it's important to have a bit of a flow back to the people who make things.
Any other question? Gentleman at the front there.
Thank you. My name is Johnny Bouchier. I'm a freelance photographer of 36 years. Mine is not so much a question as more a suggestion that was sort of mentioned earlier. For about the last 12 years, I've worked in a very specific area of photography, which is shooting interiors. When I started doing that, I was one of a fairly small group of people, comparatively small, that did that on a regular basis. And the thing which I was experiencing is how we as photographers jealously guarded our clients. And what came out of a meeting that I had with some of my colleagues about 8 years ago was that this was totally the wrong approach to take. And a group of us set up a closed group on the internet, a discussion group. It was interesting because as our clients got wind of this, they got panicked by it. They thought it was some sort of cartel that was going to sort of start setting rates and all the rest of it, where we explained, no, we were simply a discussion group. One of the things that I would urge people who are in different areas of the creative world, really, is even if you are working for potentially the same people, try and embrace that by supporting each other, that together you will glean information. I mean, I was finding that the same magazines, because they thought we weren't talking to each other, would pay different rates for exactly the same for the same work. And so it's only when you begin to talk and have some sort of dialogue going with your colleagues that you can begin to develop that. I mean, for me as an industry, I think that unfortunately, on a sort of rather down note, is that we will never get back in terms of photography to the sort of rates that, you know, I was experiencing 20, 25 years ago. That's a fact of life, and people have to find other ways of doing it. But I think to try and work together and be positive about that, I think can really, really make a difference.
Thank you very much for that. Okay, we've got time for a couple more questions. Gentleman at the back there. If you'd identify yourself, please.
I'm Andrew Potter. I'm chair of DAX and a refugee from the music industry. It strikes me that a lot of artists are very similar to what are called classical composers, people who are interested in their ideas rather than driven by any commercial objective. And they include similarly self-aggrandizing, publicly subsidized personalities just as much as I'm sure the art world does, but most of them are wonderful creators and doing their very best. But they've got a thing in the Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988 called a performing right. And every time someone performs their work, they earn some money. Should there be a viewing right so that if people are paying to look at people's work, should a percentage of that, currently it's about 5% in the music world, be going towards the artist? I don't have a problem with artists or composers or whatever being teachers as well, because I guess that's the way the baton is passed on, and I would rejoice that our best artists are teaching new artists. So I think to say artists have to teach in order to earn a living is, okay, one way of looking at it, but in another way, as a member of community, I would rejoice that great artists are passing on their skills and their ideas. Darren Henley and his jingle-strewn recommendations to the government about arts in schools. There's no sense in the visual arts community on its own taking on Michael Gove or whoever in terms of the lack of teachers. Similar problem in music. Primary teachers now get hardly any time on music during their training courses. It all has to be done in service once they're teachers. And playing a guitar in front of 30 kids needs a lot of confidence. It needs a lot of work for people to get there. And I'm sure it's the same with artists as well. The artists, the musicians, the actors, the drama teachers have to get together, I think, to make an impact in terms of what's happening to arts in education at the moment. And finally, the USA. Yes, highly creative place, but it is also the place where a student who downloaded 6 tracks illegally is currently due to pay $650,000 to the record industry for having done so. And that was a jury and not a judge who awarded that amount.
Thank you, Andrew. Any views...
Sorry, can I just ask? Who here doesn't know what Dax does? Do you all know what Dax does? That's really good news. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Can I ask the artists any views on a viewing fee?
That's a really good idea.
We'll send that one to Jeremy
actually,
Hunt.
I welcome your concern about what's happening in, you know, for music in primary schools and secondary schools and art and performance. It's a disaster and it really does need opposing, so well done.
I have two more questions, one at the back there and then gentleman at the front.
Yes, I have a question related to education.
Could you say who you are, please?
Sorry, my name is Duncan Clark. I'm a researcher in fine art photography, curator and fine art photographer. My question relates to education and how you feel the sort of next 5 years, medium term, long term, will sort of pan out with the education changes that have taken place relating to fees.
I think kind of Bob nailed it earlier on, actually. I mean, I think there's a worry about arts and humanities being marginalised in further and higher education, really, and that's a real concern. And I met up with an analyst from the Institute of Education a few months ago who said he thought that actually the arts could easily get virtually wiped out in a number of universities over a period of time, not just because of fees, but because of a combination of different factors. I hope that's not the case, but it's just really disturbing. And I think it's right through from primary right up to higher education. We are seeing a kind of premium put on wanting to actually get involved with learning anything about the arts, doing it or anything else, actually. And it's everybody's concern. It's not just for the visual arts. It's across the board. I mean, almost nobody's being left alone on this. So it's just a big worry.
I think I've said that I think it's very depressing. And it's really... You know, it's really about saying, you know, who makes our culture, who can participate in it, who's going to actually, be the interpreters of what it meant to live in the 21st century. I think that might end up being the people showing on the booths at Frieze rather than any of you lot, if we're not careful. But we all have a duty. Not necessarily a right, but we do have a kind of a duty, maybe it is a right to have our voices floating around out there as culture, and we need to make sure, try and preserve that those voices can be heard in all sorts of different ways, at all sorts of different levels.
I say more than once, working as a curator, I've been in a position where I've talked to the parents of young artists who were really, really concerned about their children going into fine art and really desperately wanted them to do something useful like accountancy or, you know, medicine.
Well, I tell you, the tricky thing is, I don't know if this is your
I think
your
they're going
case.
To be more worried.
The tricky thing is if your son and daughter meets another son or daughter who is also an artist, then penury ensues. Both of you, you know, and actually that there's a serious point there because you've got kids, haven't you?
Yeah.
It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, how do you, I think it is possible, actually. It's not completely impossible. I mean, I could, if it was just me, I could live off the sales of my work. But because I have a family, it's very, very difficult. And it does mean that people can't just live a normal kind of existence, you know. And people are having kids much, much later. It's a really difficult issue, actually, that.
I mean, in my case, my children, after, you know, living with me for so long and seeing me, an artist that struggles every now and then, and I definitely don't want to go into the arts. They do not. I won't advise it to anyone for that matter.
I think there's two questions, these two, and those will have to be our last, unfortunately, but... okay.
We are talking about...
Could you say who you are, please?
My name is Jacob. I'm a fine art photographer. We are talking about the present, but I've just turned 41, and all of a sudden I think about the future, the pension, the options that I have, and actually I don't know who I can ask, who I can consult with, what are my options, if you can just give us some references or directions where we can start research.
I mean, I think there's obviously sources of information, but I think, again, I mean, I'm going back to the same, sound like a stuck record here a bit. Again, I think it's about actually sharing experiences. I mean, the best way, the best advice you can get is probably from another artist, actually, after accessing all the good information that's available. In a sense, people will find solutions to things that in a sense, institutions quite often haven't thought of, ways of actually making sense of, ways of dividing time up, ways of actually trying to... Pension advice? I don't know. I've got no idea. I wouldn't mind some myself, actually. but I think that, you know, there are certainly advisors within a lot of the organisations we've mentioned who could actually help on some of those issues.
Sorry, did you say pension?
Yeah.
I don't know one
artist with
a pension.
No, absolutely.
I think really talking to artists, really, because we tend to think because we're artists and we tend to work on our own that that's the way it is and that the way it should be. But I think, I mean, I find that in England people are really shy to ask questions about, you know, how much you earn or what was the fee you got for that job or whatever. And I find myself, I don't have a problem sharing this information at all, because I believe that more we share it, more we know also what to ask, you know, in some situation. But I do think here, yes, you know, artists tend to not want to. I see it more as a business, you know, where I get a wage, you know, at the end of the year. It changes all the time because depending on what I do. But I'm quite happy to share sometimes some of this information because, you know, there is no shame if you're not doing so well, and it's brilliant if you're doing well anyway. So, you know, I
yes, possibly. There's a lot to do. I've been taking notes throughout. Bob, did you want to say anything?
Well, I think like all self-employed people, I don't have a pension, or like lots of self-employed people, I don't have any kind of pension, but it does mean I didn't lose lots of money to pensions, and so it's a kind of double-edged sword, isn't it? But the issue is actually, I think lots of artists do. I mean, I know I do labour under this delusion that things will get better. And I know lots of artists now, you know, who are my teachers and, you know, mentors and things, and they're in a very difficult situation. And, you know, the only thing I can say to you is, for in terms of mental health, is just to keep working. But that's no answer, is it?
But just on a serious note, to pick up what you said, the artist... focused organisations have been having conversations about how we could work together as well and how we could support artists in these difficult times. So those conversations are happening, and I'm very certain that there will be lots of outcomes to those conversations which are practical and hopefully useful. I think, Russell, you had a question, and that'll be the last question, I think.
I'm Russell Martin, and I work at ArtQuest, and I'm also a visual artist. I actually have some comments from Twitter, which I thought we might finish off with, which is, it's the first time I've ever done this and people have actually responded. There's actually been a lot of conversation on Twitter, as we've all been tweeting. In response to one of Zeynep's points about the stinginess of the UK. Yeah, I know people aren't listening. In response to the stinginess of fees, someone made the point that it seems to be the work that's valued more than the artist is. So the work is taken care of and insured, and money is spent on shipping it and transporting it and everything, but the artist is sort of marginalised in that. Something in response to something that Bob said about feeling like he's robbing the taxpayer if he gets public funding. An artist made the point that we're also taxpayers, so we're also contributing to that pot of money that we're getting money from as well. Someone also said that in response to artists working together and not kind of negotiating together or talking to each other, saying that a lot of artists will be willing to work for less or work for no money, you know, in order just to get a leg up in their career. So there's a real kind of mountain to climb in terms of that group negotiation of things. And finally, a very pragmatic question that came through from David Blandy, who wanted to ask the panel what they think a fair exhibition fee for artists would be.
Take a shot at that, John.
Zineb
and Bob, what's a fair exhibition fee?
It depends if it's a group show or a solo show, first of all. Well, it's difficult to say because it depends on the budget of the exhibition. It depends on whether there is a catalogue or not. For a group show, I would say perhaps if you get £500, it's not bad. Most of the time, you'll get 200. That's the fee. I think that actually is the official art council fee, isn't it? 250 or something like that? If there is one.
There isn't one anymore.
There isn't an official arts council fee at all anymore because it was anti-competitive for them to set suggested fees, so they weren't allowed to do that anymore.
I like David Blandy's art, and I would sell my house to see him perform.
Well, just to tell you, when I was working at the Hayward, they used to offer an exhibition fee, this is some time ago, of £100 for a solo show. But when Jasper Johns had a solo show, they decided it was too embarrassing to offer him £100, so they scrapped the fees entirely. So on that note, ladies and gentlemen, a big, big thank you to John Kiefer. And an enormous thank you to Zineb and Bob for their contributions, which have been wonderful. Thank you also for your contributions, for listening, for most of all participating. After all, participation is key. And we'd love you to stay and participate in sharing some wine with us. Right behind you, there's some white wine and red wine. Please do stay with us, continue the conversation, and exchange experiences. Thank you all very much.